This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
And a very good afternoon to you. Shortly, agricultural economist Denis Vosnesensky is going to be here and just talking about the possibility of a formal resumption of Australia's canola trade to China, which he thinks would be an incredible market gain for Australian farmers. Denis will be along just after the news headlines at 12:30 today. Also, it's still a little too early to tell what the full impact of this week's storms will have on WA's overall grain harvest. The hailstorms do look isolated and very intense at this stage to parts of the wheat belt and Great Southern, and really terrible for those individual farms affected. But the overall state does look like it's still on track for a record harvest. Now, the next crop update isn't due for another couple of weeks, so maybe that's when we really get a true sense of the picture. Meanwhile, Michael Lange, a mixed farmer with properties east of Narrogin and east of Wickapen, has certainly seen some hail damage in some neighbouring crops.
We've been really, really fortunate this time around, but not too far away from us. I know it's not the same story. Definitely you can see hail damage driving along the road in canola. You can see the tops of the crops, that, you know, the pods are shattered. How bad it is down into the crop, I really don't know. But I have definitely heard of reports of guys that have lost pretty well whole crops.
And if you've got something to add to that conversation, it really would be great to hear from you this afternoon. What have you seen in your own backyard, in neighbouring crops? Let me know on the text 0448 922 604. 12:07 here on the Country Hour. The Kimberley's iconic Kalyeda station, run by the Camp family for the past 30 years, has sold to new owners for a price tag of over $27 million. Neramut Pastoral Company has added the 123,000-hectare property to its portfolio, which includes Kalyeda's neighbour, Neramut Station. The group now holds more than 320,000 hectares of land in the Kimberley across both of the stations. One of the lead agents for the sale was Simon Wilkinson. He says the sale price met the vendor's expectations.
Very happy to report that, you know, we took it out to, through our marketing campaign, as offers from $27.5 million. And whilst I won't report on the final number, it was in line with our price guidance to the market.
So you had four interested parties. What was driving that interest in Kalyeda, do you think?
I believe it's right up there as one of the best, if not the most well-developed property across Western Australia, and a real credit to Peter Camp and his late wife Cheryl and family on developing that over the last 30 years. There wasn't a stone unturned from, you know, water systems through to fencing, through to the housing complex. State-of-the-art set of yards built a couple of years ago, you know, which was sort of circa $900,000 to $1 million expenditure. The water systems were just next level, into tanks, all into troughs, and most importantly, magnificent herd of predominantly drought master cattle went with the sale, Jess, and a very, very quality, well looked after plant and equipment list.
Kalyeda is a big name up here in the Kimberley. What does a big sale like this say about confidence in the Kimberley pastoral market right now?
Yeah, it's a great point, and confidence, I'd say, is high. I think, as reported recently, the Yeda and KMC transaction's been completed, which is fantastic news. There's, you know, already reports of a healthy CapEx budget occurring. You know, I'd say the Kimberley's in good hands, and the future's very bright. You know, with live export and KMC will be up and running, hopefully in the not-too-distant future. Yeah, very positive.
Are we seeing more outside interest in Kimberley stations these days, or is it mostly local and family buyers?
I'd say it's 50-50. A couple of years ago, Jess, there was a significant transaction occurred up there in the Kimberley with a multitude of stations. But right now, there's still, you know, strong family interest. The interest that we received predominantly, or the, you know, the final expressions of interest from the four parties were all local, established West Australian, well, predominantly farming businesses that were looking for a high-level, high-scale Kimberley asset.
Lord Real Estate Director Simon Wilkinson speaking to Jess Baker about the sale of Kalyeda Station to Nerima Pastoral Company, which is expected to settle in a couple of weeks. Nerima Pastoral Company is owned by the Emanuel family, which has been a major figure in the Australian pastoral industry for generations. The family was among the first to establish livestock properties in the Kimberley in the late 1800s. 10 past 12. The state government's incentive scheme to encourage producers to electronically tag their sheep and goats has been extended for another year. The adoption of a mandatory electronic ID system for the livestock is a way of improving traceability practices for more efficient management of disease outbreaks, food safety issues, and also market access. Now, there are a range of these EID tags on the market, and the prices can vary from one brand to the next. But as a ballpark figure, they're around about $2 each. When the tag incentive payment, or TIP, was introduced in 2023, the state government was offering a 75-cent discount on the tags. From January, the discount will be 60 cents. DeepHerd's Michael Britton says the scheme helps in the transition process to the new system.
It's important that the tag incentive scheme continues into 2026, which is our final year of EID implementation, with us reaching the final date of implementation on the 1st of July 2026, and that scheme enables as much early adoption and market saturation as possible.
More than 10 million tags have already been sold. That's a pretty big milestone. What does that tell you about how producers are responding to EID tags so far?
We're really impressed by the fact that 10 million EIDs have been sold under the state government's tag discount program. What's particularly impressive is the fact that 5 million of those were sold prior to the first stage of EID becoming mandatory. So that demonstrates a really encouraging level of early adoption by producers and a fairly widespread embracement by broader industry.
Traceability is key to protecting markets and managing disease risks. How will or do these electronic ID tags improve that response?
Yeah, absolutely. So under the mob-based movement rules that have been in place for some time, there absolutely was traceability through the use of waybills and moving mobs of sheep and goats from various locations to various locations. Under the EID system, I guess the advantage is that we get to track individual animals. So you get to track an individual animal, its lifetime journey, just with one EID for life. That's all it needs. And you're able to trace where it originated, which sheep and goats it may have mixed with along the lifespan, and then right into the food chain at the end, where you're able to get this full lifetime traceability out of the national database in a timely manner that will help governments and industry trace back that entire lifetime movement, and in the event of, you know, any emergency disease outbreaks or any other emergency situations, you're actually able to get down to the individual animal level rather than mobs. So you get a far more granular picture of where those sheep and goats have gone.
We've seen previously that it was a 75% discount and now it's 60. Can you tell me a little bit about that and why there is a decrease?
Yeah, sure. So in the last 3 years of the tag discount scheme, the state government has provided a 75-cent discount on the sale of accredited EID tags. And we don't necessarily see that in moving into 2026, where there'll be a 60-cent discount. We see that not as a decrease, but an extension of the program into 2026, in that the program will continue, and it will continue to provide a discount for producers. And not only is it an extension into 2026, but it's also an expansion into 2026, because of the last 3 years of the scheme, we've only covered year of birth tags, whereas in 2026, the 60-cent discount on tags will not only apply to year of birth tags, but also yellow EIDs and pink EIDs for older stock as well, which will help those farmers who haven't yet had the chance to tag their older stock to get EID tags in those years as soon as possible.
What is the benefit for producers here?
Yeah, sure. So the benefit for producers is that the EID system will enhance traceability, and that's really important around reducing the impact of emergency animal disease incidents. It's also about market access, where there's an increasing consumer demand both domestically and abroad for people to know where their meat products have come from. And we're also seeing it assist producers on site with on site farm management practices for individual tracing of individual sheep, goat growth, yields, and those sorts of things. So there's a broad range of benefits that are both present to producers right now and will emerge into the future as well.
DPIRD's Animal Product Integrity and Traceability Manager, Michael Britton, speaking to Rachel Boothman about the state government's incentive scheme to encourage producers to electronically tag their sheep and goats, and the news being that that scheme has been extended for another year. David Vandenberg is the principal at the Wattledale Fine Merino Stud at Scadden in the Esperance region. Dave, what do you make of the extension of the tag incentive payment, and this time including older sheep?
Look, I think it's a very positive thing that they have extended this. I would hope that they extend it for a little longer, particularly on them older sheep, which you know, have to come through the system in the next few years.
Why is it so important to extend it beyond what it looks like now? It's going to be extended up until the implementation of the scheme when it becomes mandatory in July next year.
I think it's important that you keep that confidence in the sheep, and also making sure that people retain them older ewes and not be tempted to sell them early so they don't have to tag them. Even though it's not a huge cost, it is a fair labour burden and not a pleasant job to go and re-tag adult sheep.
Is that what you're seeing at the moment? Is that sort of action decisions that are being made on farm?
I don't think there's much of that. I mean, the people that are opting out have already made their decision, you know, probably long before this came in. But it just gives people opportunity that have done the right thing and started electronic tagging as the minute it came in, just to phase out them older breeding ewes.
What are the implications, though, if that's the sort of decision that's being made on farm, the implications for, well, in particular, the flock, the future of the sheep industry here in WA?
Well, look, we just don't have enough merino ewes to rebreed our flock. We're all breeding more than we can breed. So every mob that gets sold early and not put back into lamb is going to take a lot of work to get those numbers back.
And how are you feeling? What's your confidence around the extension of the tag incentive payment beyond July next year? Are you getting any sense of that?
Well, I haven't really heard much from government about it. I think the fair hiding they've given the sheep industry over the last few years, I think they should do the right thing. We're owed a couple, not favours, but we're owed a bit of justice.
So you'd be confident it does extend beyond July next year?
Well, I don't think you'd be confident on anything in government, really. I'm just hoping that the right people get in their ear and you know, it is very important for our processors and our farmers to keep a strong industry.
All right. Well, you remain hopeful then. What's the kind of uptake, do you think, around these tags? What are you seeing on the ground?
I don't think there'd be anyone that's not electronically tagging lambs, and it was, you know, it was sort of mandatory to do it this year. I think people will get around the fact if there's a little bit of give and take from government, people will comply. I mean, it's at a point, it's not really so much of a cost burden now because the profitability is very good. It's just the extra workload of tagging them older sheep and you know, the compliance.
Well, good to get your thoughts, Dave. How's it looking round your way?
Well, the weather's crap, but everything else is pretty good. Livestock is great. Grain prices could do a little bit of a lift, but yields have been fairly good and we've had good weather up till now.
And so you've had some rain this week?
Well, we haven't had a lot. We're thankful that we haven't had big totals, but we've just had drizzly, annoying rain, which has, you know, stopped the flow of grain, basically.
All right. So you've pulled up stumps on harvest for now?
Yeah, it's drenching sheep and putting them on the stubble. So it doesn't really stop when you get livestock.
I'll let you get back to it. Good to talk to you, Dave. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
David Vandenberg, he's a principal at the Wattledale Stud at Scadden in the Esperance region, 20 past 12. And this on the text from Susan, why do we have to use EID tags in crossbreds going straight to abattoirs at only 5 or 6 months old? That is the question that keeps popping up, Susan. And I don't think there's any way around that situation. Thanks for your text, though. The text is 0448 922 604, and Dave was just talking about a little bit of rain at his place in the last couple of days or so. Others have had a lot more, and we'll cross to the Bureau of Meteorology shortly and see what lies ahead. 21 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Get to the news headlines in, what, about 9 minutes or so. First, though, an award-winning business owner in WA's Wheat Belt says she wants to see more support for regional businesses from all levels of government. Mandy Walker owns a mechanical and fabrication business at Wongan Hills, and in 2024, she won the WA AgriFutures Rural Women's Award for an ambitious project connecting regional businesses with opportunities in bigger supply chains, such as large spend defence projects. About 18 months on from winning the award, Mandy says the opportunities remain pretty obvious, but the practicalities of doing business in the bush makes it really challenging for some businesses to grow and reach their full potential.
The award enabled me to travel to see defence personnel and representatives and talk the idea through, and also to the primes, the businesses that work with defence and their subcontractors as well, to understand where regional businesses like mine could fit into that supply chain. So there was a lot of background work, socialising the idea, and a lot of support that came from that. People just said, wow, that is really a great idea and quite innovative. Mm. We didn't think of that before. And then transposing that to what we do in the regions, it really became an elegant solution to supporting us through our boom and bust cycles around agriculture.
And there was appetite there, you were hearing from those defence personnel and the service providers that you met with, they could also see the opportunity that you could see?
Absolutely. They understood the future for the defence industry is, you know, it's advanced manufacturing, it's advanced service delivery and technologies, but we still require the everyday run-of-the-mill fabrication and maintenance and servicing of equipment to be undertaken. And a business like mine fits perfectly into that because that's our core business, that's our skill. And we're not interested in going down the high-tech robotic line of advanced manufacturing and inventions, but we feel that we can backfill the gap that's created by those businesses that are embarking on that journey.
What's the process been like, though, trying to get this off the ground and still working from and within a regional area?
It's an elegant solution on paper, I must admit. The idea and concept, it supports business, it supports regional development goals and the idea of maintaining vibrant regional communities. And it also supports this overwhelming investment in defence. Every day we hear continual investments being made. And if you consider all that on paper, it looks great. The idea of a cooperative of businesses where they can provide piecemeal parts into that supply chain really does highlight, I suppose, that benefit of collaborative working together and the capitalising on investment that's being made. The reality for us, though, is that this is one piece of a bigger regional business ecosystem. There are many challenges and constraints that face regional businesses around the equity of operating in the regions. And that for me has really made me step back and think, is this the right business model to pursue and the right project to pursue given that we have a lot of other constraints holding us back in our everyday operations.
What are those constraints, Mandy? Can you give me some practical examples of what you're dealing with every day?
Look, everyone is familiar with the workforce and housing constraints, so I won't head there, but that is a reality for us. But there's things around systemic bias in the way industry operates with us. So things like courier companies requiring us to have a minimum spend that is well beyond our annual or our monthly spend for deliveries just means I have to go to Perth to get my parts, and I have to wait weeks for things to be delivered. That at an operational level, not a lot of people understand that or hear that. They just understand that their machine's not being fixed and they want to know why.
When you look at the challenges that you're facing, are there solutions that could be implemented from a state or a federal or even a local government level that would perhaps allow more regional business growth?
There's a whole suite of things we could have a discussion around, like you said, all three levels of government. So you mentioned land being available. That requires local government to be ready to develop that and facilitate that, rather than a business having to take months and months for planning approval and then, you know, a week to build a shed. It heavily biased around the regulation piece is not supported by people who can help you implement that and overcome those challenges and be proactive and facilitative. So, yes, that at that local level, there's opportunity to help businesses grow. At state level, there's opportunities around, you know, the cost of living in the regions. Perhaps there's incentives around being able to reduce that cost through fuel subsidy or living expenses. And then at a federal level, you can look at policy and regulatory change around determining an area within the wheat belt, perhaps, that becomes a zone where pay-as-you-go tax is less or nothing, so we can get that wage attractiveness like the FIFO mining sector has.
The concept that you brought to the AgriFutures Awards, that is what we've been talking about, and that has proven difficult in reality of actually getting up off the ground. But the process that you went through, the people that you met and spoke with, do you still see that as valuable, even though you haven't been able to get this cooperative model you wanted it to be?
Look, defence is it's a generational investment being made by the government. So it's, you know, I'm only 18, 24 months into this. This, we're talking, you know, 40, 50 years of investment. This opportunity to harness that investment and use that to the benefit of the regions is absolutely still there.
2026 nominations are closing soon. If someone was on the fence listening to this going, oh, I'm not sure whether or not I should apply, what would you say to them?
Absolutely put your application in. There's nothing you can lose from having somebody look at your idea and think, wow, we should probably talk to this lady around what she's doing. What it does provide is a platform to be heard. It opens doors for you and it gives you that monetary support through the Westpac bursary to go and do the groundwork or extend what you're doing to see your project succeed.
2024 WA AgriFutures Rural Women's Award winner Mandy Walker, who owns Walker's Diesel Services in the Wheatbelt. She was speaking to Jo Prendergast, and applications for the 2026 Rural Women's Award close today. And the state winner receives a $15,000 bursary for their project, business or program, and access to professional development opportunities and alumni networks. So if you want to nominate or know someone who should, head to agrifutures.com.au. 29 past 12, Jonathan Hopper in the studio with the news headlines.
Good afternoon, Belinda. Federal opposition leader Susan Lee is insisting she has the support of her party room. It follows claims from Liberal Senator Sarah Henderson that she's losing support within the Liberal Party. The remarks come ahead of a key meeting in Canberra next week where the Liberals will decide whether or not to keep a net zero emissions by 2050 target. The Australian Workers Union says employees of WA's Containers for Change program deserve better pay for the conditions they face on the job. Containers for Change employs more than 850 people and pays them the minimum wage rate of just over $25 an hour. The AEWU says Containers for Change workers are exposed to excessive noise, traffic and broken glass, but are paid less than other workers in similar roles. And Socceroos coach Tony Popovich has named seven potential debutants in the squad to face Colombia and Venezuela this month. Perth-born Manchester United squad member James Overy has been called up despite not yet making a senior appearance at Old Trafford. Thanks, Belinda.
Thank you for the update, Jonathan. It is 12:30 here on the Country Hour. Still to come, Justin Haydock. He's going to be here just before the news at 1. He'll go through this week's wool market results for you. And also, Dennis Woznesensky will be here. He's an agricultural economist. And just with the news that that ship is being loaded at the Port of Esperance, loaded with canola, around about, I think, 65,000 tonnes of canola headed for China, which is a pretty big deal. It's been named a trial shipment at this point. But if that goes really smoothly, this could really open that market again, which, well, the last time a shipment of canola went to China from Australia was back in 2020. So we'll look at what the possibility of that market formally opening again might mean for Australian growers. 29 to 1. Let's head to the Bureau of Meteorology and Angeline Prasad with you this afternoon. Ange, what's the story across the Southwest Land Division?
Good afternoon, Belle. Well, we've got a firm ridge of high pressure developing across southern WA, still maintaining a moist southeasterly flow today. So there's still some very light showers lingering across the Great Southern and across the coastal districts. The showers will mostly contract to the south coast tomorrow, and we are looking at a drier pattern settling over much of the Southwest Land Division until probably Tuesday or Wednesday next week. So this ridge will hang around with the west coast trough developing. The west coast trough is going to bring in some warmer temperatures to the western parts of the Southwest Land Division. So by late weekend, we see temperatures in the central west, the northern parts of the central wheat belt and the lower west get above 30 degrees, the daytime temperatures. But that ridge isn't going anywhere anytime soon. So it will maintain drier conditions until probably at this stage Tuesday. You'll probably start to see one or two thunderstorms developing across the central west, maybe as early as Sunday or Monday, but it will stay to the north until probably Wednesday when we'll see a weak front come through. So that will mobilize the west coast trough, and the west coast trough will move inland, so drag in moisture further into the southwest land divisions. And well, that's probably when we'll see showers and the odd thunderstorms return to inland parts of the southwest land division. But until then, expecting fairly settled weather heading into next week.
All right, let's take a look around northern and eastern parts of the state now.
It's pretty typical for this time of the year across the rest of the state. The light showers I mentioned are still hanging around southern parts of the goldfields and the Eucla and the adjacent interior, and that too will gradually clear off in the next 24 hours. So I'm looking at settled conditions persisting through these areas until probably Monday or Tuesday next week, when showers expected to return. It's pretty quiet across the Pilbara and also the Gascoyne, but we'll see that west coast trough deepening, so the heat continues to build up a little bit. Temperatures will generally remain typical for this time of the year, but we'll see days, especially across northwestern parts of the Gascoyne, the Pilbara, reach above 40 degrees, which again is more or less typical for this time of the year. As that west coast trough evolves next week, we'll see mainly drier thunderstorms develop across the Gascoyne and the northern parts of the goldfields into the interior on Sunday, and then increase a little bit more as we head into next week. In fact, next week, as that moisture builds across central Australia, central WA, it is going to drag in a fair amount of moisture from the tropics, so it's possible we could see severe thunderstorms return to central parts of the state sort of Monday or Tuesday onwards. Across the Kimberley, expecting seasonal showers and thunderstorms to continue mainly across northern and eastern parts of the district. And as I mentioned, as that moisture develops through a central WA on Monday, it also means that moisture will develop or deepen on Monday across the north as well. So we'll see increasing showers and thunderstorms across the north as well.
Thanks so much for that, Ange. Appreciate it. 25 to 1. Let's take a look at the rainfall figures now. So a look back at the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, checking 5 mils and over. Northern and eastern forecast districts in the Kimberley, Halls Creek Airport 8 and Mount House Airstrip had 6. Then into the Southwest Land Division in the southwest, Cape Lewin 17, Carradale 5. Southern Coastal Region, Dalyup Park 5, Denbarker 20 over 3 days. Esperance Arrow had 6, Mount Howick 9 over 3 days, Munglinup 6, Munglinup West 6, Pleasant Valley 7, and Warrajarra had 8 over 2 days. And in the Great Southern, Chamming Up 11. 25 to 1. We'll get a wrap of the wool market with Justin Haydock just before the news at 1. But speaking of the weather, farmers across WA's Great Southern and the Wheat Belt are still counting the cost after heavy hail and heavy rain lashed the regions this week, with crops really taking a major hit. On the Country Hour yesterday, you heard from farmers in areas northeast and east of Perth, where the wild weather tore through some farms and left a trail of damage. Michael Lange is a mixed farmer with properties east of Narrogin and east of Wickapen. That area, which is 210 kilometres southeast of Perth, also copped some heavy rainfall and hail. Michael says they were really lucky that the hail missed them this time, but unfortunately it's a different story for some neighbouring farms.
Well, we sort of knew the weather was coming with a bit of trepidation. But fortunately for us, we got a fair bit of rain, but I don't think we've seen any hail damage with us, but definitely neighbours around us have definitely got a hail damage in Canola. It's more the northern part of the Narrogin Shire and the Wickapen Shire, I think, that's gone through there. But certainly the rain has put a stop to things for a few days. And if you happen to be under the wrong cloud, well, you might be stopped longer.
How much rain did you guys get in total on your farm?
At our home place between Narrogin and Wickapen, we end up with about 40 mil. But out east of Wickapen, we managed to dodge the clouds out there, and we probably only got about 4 mil. But there's people not too far away from us, they would have got 40 or 50 mil, I'm positive of that.
What's wild to me, Michael, is just how varied it is. And as you said yourself, like, if you're under the wrong cloud or the wrong cell, it's just wild how that variability.
Yeah, well, that's the nature of what we get with storms this time of the year. We've been on the losing side of it in years gone by, for sure.
Have you had a chance to have a good look around to see if you have had extensive damage in parts of your property? What have you seen?
Well, yeah, I have had a reasonable look around, and like I said, we've been really, really fortunate this time around, but not too far away from us. I know it's not the same story. Well, guys, yeah, definitely you can see hail damage driving along the road in Canola. You can see the tops of the crops, that, you know, the pods are shattered. How bad it is down into the crop, I really don't know, but I have definitely heard of reports of guys that have lost pretty well whole crops. I don't know how big the area is, but once again, it's isolated areas.
What about for you? Obviously, 40 mils of rain is a lot. Has it done anything else to your program, like affected any other parts of your program?
Usually the first rain you can get away with a little bit, but if we get another one in the next week or two, well, then we'll definitely see some sort of quality damage to barley with staining, and depends, the wheat might be okay, but once again, you know, once we've had this sort of storm through in Canola, if you haven't got it off, it's made it more brittle. So it's definitely a concern, but what do you do? It's nature.
What stage are you up to in your program? Had you started harvest?
No, we hadn't started harvest. We're probably only going to look at sometime this week. we've still got a little bit of export hay we're doing out wandering direction. Fortunately, they dodged the clouds as well, and they only got 3 or 4 mil as well, so hopefully that won't slow us down too much there. We've still got a bit of export hay stacked out the paddocks. Fortunately for that too, that has had very little on it. So the heat will be on to get that moved. But I know there's still a fair bit of hay on the ground around the place, and still quite a bit stacked out in paddocks too.
The forecast for the next couple of days, it looks like, I had a quick search on the Bureau, and it looks like it is going to be warming up. I think I saw on Sunday in Wickapen it could get up to 30, or at least close to. How does that make you feel?
Oh, definitely, yeah, makes you feel a bit easier, because then you can get stuck into things and get things moving. Look, ideally we need a bit of breeze at the moment, and not too much hot weather in the next couple of days to dry things out a little bit. If it does that, well, then your quality issues tend to be a little bit less. If we get that hot, steamy weather, that tends to create quality issues a lot quicker.
When do you guys expect you'll be, I mean, you haven't even started, so maybe this is a bit of a presumptuous question, but when do you expect now to be finishing because of this rain? Do you think that's going to, you know, prolong things quite a bit?
Well, how long's a piece of string?
I was going to say, do you have your crystal ball handy there, Michael?
Look, traditionally we're pretty well wrapped up around Christmas time, but I can quite easily see it extending, you know, past that this year. And guys with bigger programs, yeah, 100%, I reckon it's going to go, you know, extend into January this year.
Well, fingers crossed for the rest of harvest, Michael, and thanks for chatting on the Country Hour today.
No worries, pleasure.
Michael Lange speaking to Kate Forrester about the rain he got at his farm. And if you want to see some photos of the damage and the hail that fell this week across the grain growing regions, search online ABC Rural and Wild Weather, and that's where you'll find Kate's story. Kate spoke to so many people yesterday, farmers affected by the rain and in particular the hail, and there's a whole heap of photos there and some video footage too on that story. Just search ABC Rural and Wild Weather to get a full look at the situation. I did see a video of someone walking through what was a standing crop of canola. This was at a property east of Wickapen, which had been decimated by hail. Incredible footage, really. It really did look like snow. And in the video, the farmer's just digging into, well, the ground, but it's basically all hail. And it looks like it could be 40 centimetres deep. Incredible. 18 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. In other grains industry news today, the formal resumption of Australia's canola trade to China would be an incredible market gain for Australian farmers. As you heard on the Country Hour yesterday, for the first time in 5 years, a ship was being loaded with 65,000 tonne of canola bound for Qingdao in northeast China's Shandong province. Commonwealth Bank agricultural economist Denis Voznesensky says if the trial shipment is a success, it could help support prices for oilseed.
Fingers crossed that shipment sails smoothly and we have then further shipments coming from Australia into Canada. It's incredibly important this year because our largest typical buyer, Europe, they've had a much larger crop this year, going from 16 to 19 million tonnes. So Europe won't need as much locally. We're really in a place where we do need another buyer. And if that buyer is China, that's really good news. So look, fingers crossed that everything goes fine with that shipment and we can send more. I am really watching closely what happens between Canada and China. There's a lot of meetings, not much progress at this point, but things could change tomorrow. So with these shipments, you got to keep in mind that even if there are large purchases, whether it's from us or from the US in the past, there have been times where those shipments have been cancelled. And that's what we've got to keep an eye on.
It really does sound like quite a volatile hold your breath moment by the sound of things.
Well, yeah, it feels like it's been that way since COVID. The market's become incredibly volatile. And when you have markets driven more by politics as opposed to typical supply and demand, you really have to be switched on and on the ball constantly.
China was a really significant customer for Australian canola before that trade was shut. If they were to resume that position and the door to trade was to formally open beyond these trials, what would that mean in terms of potential price influence on the ground?
It would definitely be supportive. Historically, because the demand from Europe has really been government-driven, and when I say that, it's been to create, our canola has been used to crush, and then the oil has been going towards biofuel. And that biofuel, the amount they need to make, is really driven by the European Union. So Europe has always been offering us a really high price, and that's been supporting the demand for our canola now for a very long time. Having China as an additional buyer would just support those prices and that demand further. China historically, yes, has been a very large buyer before the ceasing of our purchases. So it would only be good news if China was back.
If I had some canola to sell, you'd really be feeling a bit anxious, wouldn't you? Because it sounds like it could go rapidly one way or the other if China and Canada sort out their problems. And there's all this soy coming in from the US, and that could have a negative impact on pricing. But then if the market reopens to China formally between Australia and China, then that could push things up the other way. It really sounds like it's at a real sort of fork in the road.
Look, at this point, you have larger production in Europe. Canada, when I was there earlier in the year, it was a bit dry. When I was leaving, this was around June, July, it started raining. It never really stopped. They ended up having a decent crop. They're typically our largest competitor. So overall, there before the announcement that China is back, there wasn't any substantial reason for large upside in canola. It was just more likely you're just going to track the way it has been more flatlined. But now with China back, if they do stick around, it would be supportive of canola prices. And I think even the thought of that has been holding up canola prices more than otherwise it would have been. So from the perspective of what do you look for? Well, if China stays in the market, that should be supportive. We have two large buyers then, Europe and China. If they renege on the current contracts, that's of course something to watch on the downside.
Commonwealth Bank agricultural economist Denis Woznesensky speaking to Joe Prendergast, and it really does feel like until that delivery lands in China and it gets the green light, once it gets there, there's a little bit of anxious nerves in the system, in the market at the moment. You can read more about the story online. Just search ABC China and canola, and the online story is there for you to have a read through. 14 to 1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
Artificial intelligence is the latest weapon in the war on feral pigs in far north Queensland. It's being used for surveillance and also monitoring of the exploding wild pig population, particularly where national parks adjoin cane fields. Landline's Courtney Wilson has the story.
As the sun fades on this far north Queensland cane farm, the day isn't winding down for everyone.
Right. Earmuffs on, chuck them on the gun, get it ready.
Ross Bowerman's regular job is as a supervisor at the nearby Mulgrave Sugar Mill, but he's getting ready to step into his other role.
By night, I become a pig owner for the cane farmers around Gordonvale.
In this part of the world, there is plenty to keep Ross busy. His teenage daughter often joins him on night hunts.
I'm flat out all the time. If this farmer doesn't ring, another farmer rings all the time. So every night I'm out.
Ross is part of a team of pig hunters contracted by the Mulgrave Mill. And while shooting feral pigs may seem outside of the usual scope of a sugar mill, it's become a critical part of cane production in North Queensland.
I keep in regular contact with probably a core group of about eight very good hunters around this area, and between them, you know, they're removing anywhere from 500 to 600 pigs every year.
But for the hundreds of pigs they kill, there are literally thousands and thousands more that remain running wild. The booming pig population is costing cane growers in North Queensland millions.
We estimate annually that growers in the Mulgrave area lose between about $1.2 and $1.5 million worth of revenue every year.
Mulgrave Mill field officer Matt Heshen says that damage bill doesn't quite tell the whole story because the financial burden is largely carried by just a few growers. As well as growing cane, they also share in common the fact that their farms all adjoin national parks. Farmers believe the pigs are able to hide in the protected land.
You know, when you see what pigs can do, the amount of working up of the soil, you could just about plant potatoes back into it. You know, they cultivate the soil that heavy and that deep.
Sheridan Morris is the chair of the Reef and Rainforest Research Centre based in Cairns. The not-for-profit group focuses on environmental and community well-being across the tropics. Managing feral pigs is a big part of their work.
We have a lot of protected areas. We have the Wet Tropics World Heritage Area. We have a lot of national parks. And pigs tend to hide in those areas and come out and attack or damage farms and cropping areas as a result.
On the front line of feral pig management in the far north is a group called INLOC. It's made up largely of veterans that work predominantly in remote areas and difficult terrain. Andrew Munn is a volunteer.
We manage a group of about five cane farms, and we're looking at the feral pigs coming out of the national park here and into the cane fields where they're destroying cane.
Andrew and INLOC work with a number of other individuals and groups also fighting feral pigs, including private shooters like Ross Bowerman. How they help one another is pretty simple.
We look at the locations the pigs potentially coming in, and we put free feed on each of those locations. Come back in a few days. If the feed's gone, we then put a camera there to see what's taken it, and we remove the other feed. We then try to establish a pattern.
However, the location makes managing these pest animals here tricky.
The entire eastern boundary of this farm is national park, but running off the high ground into the cane farm are a lot of creeks. Those creeks are still heavily vegetated with rainforest, which are perfect egress routes in and out of the farm, but those creeks are owned by the farmers.
It's a frustrating situation.
It's the farmer's responsibility to manage the pigs on their land, but here, that's not their jurisdiction, is that right?
That's right. So we could manage the 13 pigs when they were sitting there eating them, eating the bananas, but if they were just over here, they're in National Park, and there's nothing we can do about that.
The Queensland Environment Department manages nearly 15 million hectares of protected land and says many millions are spent controlling feral animals. It says it prioritises the most effective techniques to control feral pigs, particularly in North Queensland, and wherever possible, its rangers work closely with adjoining landholders. A lot of technology is used by private operators. Time and patience is spent figuring out the best ways to monitor, trap and kill feral pigs in this landscape. At times, the fight really does resemble a military operation.
Yeah, you stay here because I'll be shooting. You've got the house over here.
Yep.
Individual action like this is critical, but it's not nearly enough. Sheridan Morris believes artificial intelligence, specifically for surveillance and monitoring of feral pigs, is a big part of the solution.
We need a whole lot of science to develop an integrated pest management framework for feral pigs into the future.
The goal is to stop wasting money by funding smaller, disjointed efforts and instead channel money, energy, time and intelligence to the most cost-effective control targets.
We need a very good understanding of not only how pigs breed and their behaviour and their habitat use, but we also need to know where we can actually intercept their process to get best control.
Sheridan Morris is the chair of the Reef and Rainforest Research Centre. Ending that report from Courtney Wilson. And for the full story, tune in to Landline this Sunday from 12:30 on ABC TV. 7 minutes to 1 here on the Country Hour. Shortly, getting a full wrap of the wool market, looking at sales here in the West and what happened at sales on the East Coast with Justin Haydock. First, though, let's head to Bali, where a butcher shop and restaurant has been officially opened with a distinct Northern Territory flavour to it. The business is in Seminyak, a popular spot for tourists, and they're selling meat that's come from the NT's live cattle trade to Indonesia. One of the owners is Scott Riggs, who spent years as a livestock agent in the Territory. And he says the idea was born after seeing too many cattle get rejected by importers.
I just thought after 20 years of doing live export out of the Territory and seeing many, many animals get rejected because of type to suit the wet market, etc., I just had an idea of putting a butcher shop together in Seminyak in Bali and complement it with a restaurant together to utilise some of these animals and send them into Bandung and custom feed them in Jakarta, and then moving the product into Bali of a selected animal that suit the primal cuts for a butcher shop. So, yeah, I just saw a fit for the foreigners and also and the change of what's happening in Indonesia with supermarket trade and the non amount of butcher shops that are available for the everyday customer.
Yeah, can you tell us more about the cattle you're sourcing for this butcher shop and restaurant and how they're the ones that aren't quite suiting the demand of the importers in the wet markets?
Yeah, sure. So historically, Matt, as you know, the live export trade into Indonesia throughout has been supporting the wet market over the years. The wet market trade is over the last sort of 5 to 8 years has got very, very strict on the high-grade commodities, the high-grade Brahman, even to a point where they're only taking straight colours. So there's plenty of those well-bred Brahman cattle that suit that market, just purely on the fat content that's that after feeding for 90 to 120 days, that Brahman suits that market for the wet market, and that'll never go away. It's still there, which is great. But I just see plenty of mixed coloured Brahman cross cattle and flatback sort of tighter crossbred cattle just getting rejected just purely on the buyer demand from the Indonesian side and the importers. So I just thought there was a market more for them, that those animals lay down fat and suit the supermarket trade. Yeah, the product's in demand, and we've only been open for 4 weeks, so touch and go, see how it all goes, Matt.
Scott Riggs from the Top End Beef, and he was speaking to Matt Brown about his new butcher shop and restaurant selling beef from the Northern Territory to tourists in Bali. 1:05.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. With more than 3,000 billionaires already, one man is set to become the world's first trillionaire. And speaking of riches, the untold story of Monopoly, the board game turning 90 this year, which was originally invented to teach against greed and capitalism. Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces say they've agreed to a ceasefire, and park rangers on Christmas Island say they're close to a total eradication of feral cats. Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
1:04. Well, the wool market, it was fairly steady this week. The Eastern Market Indicator up 6 cents to finish the week on 1,419 cents a kilogram clean. And the Western Market Indicator also up 6 cents to close at 1,566 cents a kilo clean. Justin Haydock, what's your assessment of this week's market?
Yeah, pretty good market, Belinda. This market's just starting to find a bit of a level now after a couple of weeks on the decline. So firmed up last week, was even up a little bit in US terms. This week, the market just back a touch in US terms, 9 cents. So not much overall. The market closed at 9.24 USD. The dollar was back 0.89 of a cent. So we lost just what we gained last week with the dollar. So they're offering 30,000 bales on offer for the week, 6.1% passed in. So still a very good clearance. 17s weren't quoted in the West, but they hovered around that 2,000 cent mark and they were unchanged. 18 microns, 1867, they were up 12 for the week. 19 microns, 1734, they were up 10 cents. 20 microns, 1671, they were up 20. While 21 microns, 1658, they were unchanged for the week. Merino skirtings followed the same trend as the fleece, while merino cardings closed at 751 and they were unchanged, well, down two, sorry.
And who was buying this week?
Major buyers for the week, Tech Wool Trading purchased 17.5%. So they were out of the market last week. They did buy a bit, but not much at all. So good to see them back. PJ Morris purchased 14% of the fleece, Sequoia Materials 13.6%, TNU Wool 10.5%, in the crossbreds, Pelican Australia led the way with 22.7%, while Tech Wool Trading were right behind them at 14.4%. Merino skirtings, TNU purchased 17.6%, while Oldmans, United Wool Company, purchased 27.1%. So they were very, very strong and competitive in the Oldmans sector.
And what was it, 30,000 we had for this week, I think you said earlier, Justin? What are we looking forward to for next week?
So the initial quote was around 34, and then we offered 30,000 by the time walls were withdrawn. Next week, we are looking at a total of 30, around about 33. So we've got just under 5,000 to be sold in Fremantle. So there will be a one-day sale. in Fremantle, which will be sold on Tuesday. In Melbourne and Sydney, a two-day sale, they'll sell on Tuesday and Wednesday. So overall, this market's just found a bit of a level. I think we'll sort of hang pretty tight. We'll trade around these levels for a little bit. But what we have seen in the past is, yeah, we'll sit here for a bit and then buyers will take a position at these lower levels and the market will roll again. So fingers crossed, look, we might potentially see that before Christmas. But if not, you know, you'd like to think we'd see a similar pattern to previous years where the market has kicked in January, February.
Justin, thank you for going through the market for us. Just repeating the top story for you, the Kimberley's iconic Kalyida Station, run by the Camp family for the past 30 years, has sold to new owners for a price tag of over $27 million. Nerima Pastoral Company has added the property to its portfolio, which includes Kalyida's neighbour, Nerima Station. Great to catch up with you this afternoon. It is time for the news, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.